Well, good morning again to everybody. This whole month, we're talking about relationships. I want to start my talk this morning by sharing a verse that is often chanted in Zen retreats. May we exist like a lotus at home in the muddy water. Thus we bow to life as it is. May we exist like a lotus at home in the muddy water. Thus we bow to life as it is. At Home in the Muddy Water is a favorite book of mine. It's by this Zen teacher, Ezra Beda. And when he describes this verse, he says that it's a reminder of what the spiritual life is really all about. The willingness to open ourselves to whatever life presents, no matter how messy or complicated. Messy or complicated pretty much describes most of the relationships we have. Even the great ones are complicated, and most of them get messy now or then. So relationships are the muddy water we swim in. A lot of what makes relationships so messy and complicated is the set of expectations that we bring along to them. So this morning I want to talk about relationships through two different teachings. First, the desire, craving, and clinging, which we talk about all the time. And of course, we spent almost all last year with the dependent origination talking about that. And then secondly, some teachings on generosity. So first, desire, craving, clinging. You know, desires arise for all of us. That's normal in human beings. And then through the desire to keep what we like and get rid of what we don't like, we add expectations to all those desires. There are layers and layers of expectations. And they show up through our beliefs, our opinions, preferences, and all the stories we create around them. We want what we want, and we're sure that we deserve to get what we want. We end up believing that if we get what we want, we'll be happy. And yet we know that even when we get what we want, we're often not satisfied. Arv said in his lovely meditation that we all desire to love and be loved. You know, we're social beings and we desire to be in contact. We love having friends, neighbors, coworkers. And if we're fortunate enough, we also love having a significant relationship like a spouse or a partner. And the first level of expectations we bring is just about these relationships in themselves. You know, why do we seek them? What do we hope to get out of them? Do we hope that if we have enough of them or the right kind of them, we'll feel better about ourselves? Will we finally feel like we belong? Will we finally feel like we're likable or lovable? Do we believe that with the right number and the right kind of relationships, our life will be full? Bill's been dead almost 4 years, and as I've put my toe in the water of dating, I've been asking myself these questions a lot. You know, will life still be meaningful and joyful if I'm single? Will I find ease and contentment with or without another person in my life? These are kind of the first level of expectation. Do you care how many friends you have on Facebook or followers on Instagram? What views and expectations did we each inherit from our family, from our culture, about, you know, how many friendships we should have and what kind and all of that? So along with this first level of expectation, we also have expectations for a specific relationship. Sometimes we idealize them and have pretty unrealistic expectations. I realize that I've done that. I'm the youngest of three in my family. My older sister, Nancy, was 6 years older than me. And when I was a kid, I idolized her. She really kind of mothered me more than my own mother did. She was not only the oldest, she was really bossy. and I knew she really loved me. Family myth has it that when my mom brought me home from the hospital, that my sister and brother argued about whose room I was going to sleep in. They both seemed pretty excited about having a baby sister. I don't remember who won that argument, but I know that Nancy really liked being my older sister. She would set, when I was in middle school, she set up learning goals for me. I had to learn new words every day, use them in a sentence, and she would test me on it. You know, she taught me about classical music and folk music. She taught me about helping people when they were in trouble. I went to my first pawn shop when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11, because we had to sell some of my sister's stuff so that she could raise some money to help someone who needed to make bail. When I was older, we became best friends. And I often believe, and I think it's probably true, that that was the best friendship I've ever had in my life. But then when she died, I realized I was bringing the expectations and the experience from that friendship to other ones. You know, every person is different and every combination of two people has their own energy and dynamic. You know, there'll never be another Nancy and Susie. And that's what I was called when I was in my family. Then once we've made a new friend or in a more intimate relationship, the expectations get even more specific. This relationship should make me feel happy, strong, confident, safe. This person should be sensitive all the time, compassionate all the time, a good listener all the time, tell good jokes, be a great dancer, or for me, have a boat so that I don't have to figure out how to get out on one. You know, but the list goes on and on. And sometimes we add to these big expectations a desire for the other person to have traits that we feel we're lacking. I know that I did some of that around safety when Bill and I got together, but I had to confront, you know, what was my own view about, is this world a safe world? Can I be safe in this world? What about courage? Whatever those traits are that you feel you might be missing in yourself that we often place on these other people. And we know through our practice and through the teachings that these expectations arise out of conditioning, that all the conditioning, all the past that has brought us to this moment, we've learned so much about our conditioned views we have about ourselves and about how life should be. So then expecting that someone else is going to deal with my set of conditioning is a pretty big order. And then inevitably, the relationship fails somehow. I don't feel strong or safe. Somehow, you know, you didn't make me happy. And then we believe, oh, this relationship's no good, or you're no good, or I'm no good at relationships. So it keeps getting more and more complicated. It's no wonder that it's kind of messy and complicated. And then each person in the relationship comes with their own desires and expectations. And when these clash or conflict, people do a lot of blaming of each other and of ourselves, you know, or we believe the relationship is fatally flawed. If only I had a better partner, if only I had a more patient partner, a cuter partner, a this or that, a wealthier partner. If only you were different, I would be different. We create so many stories about this if only list, and then we end up believing them. A common one that I hear a lot, and I know it's been true in me, is this whole idea about loneliness in life. I remember a few weeks before Bill died, we were vacationing in Maine. We were exploring the entire coast and had the beautiful Acadia National Park. And a particular day we had a disagreement about how we were going to spend the morning. I wanted to do one thing and he wanted to do something else, and he got his way. After he left the cabin we were staying in, I was feeling kind of sorry for myself, and the thought arose that I felt lonely. If only Bill were more attentive to my needs. If only we had taken the walk together. That's what I wanted. I wouldn't feel lonely. But then, you know, as we all know, we've been practicing a long time, whether we want to or not, the practice kicks in. That story just didn't have the same kind of hook. And I started asking myself some questions about what was really going on. And before too long, I realized that really beneath the words, "I feel lonely," was that I didn't get what I wanted. Preferences, expectations, wanting things to last, wanting things to be different than they are, wanting people to be different than they are. How many times do we just do that? We wanted X, but we didn't get it. The feeling is unpleasant. But then instead of just being with the truth of the unpleasantness, we create a story about it. And then we apply a big label to it. In my case, that label was lonely. Then we started believing the story. Just like when we're on the cushion, when we find ourselves lost in some story, you know, we come back to our anchor, realizing, oh, this is just a story, just a way the ego is trying to make something into me and mine. And we can do the same thing, and we already do the same thing in the practice with relationships. Clinging to our views, our preferences, our beliefs, we can stop and notice the clinging. Just like Lindell was talking about last week around Vedana and the feeling tones, we can stop and notice the unpleasant. What does this unpleasant really feel like? I had to really get in touch with what I was feeling, what I was calling lonely. And, you know, was it really that? Or was it really more just disappointment? And I had to allow it to just be there. I didn't need to create a story about it. It was a moment's experience, and it was really just my experience. Bill really didn't have anything to do with it. So instead of creating stories out of these expectations, we can ask ourselves, what's really happening here? What's the truth of this situation? Last weekend at that lovely day long with Rodney, he was talking about when our sense of self gets thinner. What he meant was, you know, not so solid, not so controlling. When that happens, we can really see more clearly what's really going on. But no relationship's going to be free from mess and confusion. It's the muddy water we swim in. We're not going to avoid the mess and confusion. We just need to learn how to swim. Last month, we were talking about emotions, and Tiwari brought in the teachings on the five aggregates. It's the way we cling to emotions, and it's the same way with relationships. She talked about the five aggregates of clinging. They're just experiences that are fleeting and momentary and impersonal, and yet we call them reality. We think what we see is the full truth. The khandhas, those aggregates, as she explained, are just piles, form, feelings, thoughts, perceptions, consciousness. All these are not anything in and of themselves. We just get caught up in them all. And then we believe they're reality. She described emotions as these ropes that get all entangled, and we think that the tangle is reality. Same with relationships. We think that the mess, the entanglement, the clashes of preferences and expectations are reality. And the way we break out of getting caught up in the entanglement is through practice. We're going to continue to get caught up. The twine that Tiwari was describing that wraps us all around our emotions, it's the same twine that wraps us up around all of our experience with relationships. So how does our practice help us get unentangled and see more clearly what's happening? Well, first, we know how to get quiet. It's not just on the cushion. You know, stillness is available no matter where you are, no matter how many people are around you. We know how to find that still point, that quiet point, through our breath, through the body. We know about pausing, taking time, before we respond or react, or certainly before we speak. You know, I often do this mental image of just kind of the tape over the mouth. Just go, take it easy. We know about asking questions about what's really going on and not accepting the first answer, just like I didn't about I'm lonely. And we know how to listen to ourselves and the other. Recently, there was a great image on Facebook. It was this really large circle. And the caption on the circle was, "This is who the other person is." And then inside that circle was this teeny, teeny little dot. And that dot's caption was, "This is what we think we know about the other person." So we never fully know what another person is going through. Even in our intimate relationships, we believe we do. Tiwari was laughing about saying, oh, she knows what her son is thinking. And I think each of us in intimate relationships says, I know what you're thinking. You don't even have to tell me. Well, it's BS. We don't really know. So we ask, we listen, we seek to understand, and we let go even for just a moment our preconceived ideas and opinions. And then having taken the precepts and living our lives by them, we know how to be honest and kind in our lives and how to live our lives from the ground of our true values. Those values really help us when we're swimming around in these muddy waters. So all these khandhas, their expectations, perceptions, beliefs, opinions about ourselves, about the other person, about the relationship itself, just deserves to be examined. What am I clinging to? How identified am I with what's going on and with who I am in this relationship? You know, for all the years that Bill and I were together, and we ran our recycling company and we built this property, it was Bill and Susan, Bill and Susan, Bill and Susan, or Susan Bill, you know. And so then when he was gone, it was like, well, where's the Sue's who used to be the Bill and Sue's part, you know? And we all do that kind of taking a lot of our identification from our relationships. And asking, you know, in any relationship, am I adding to the suffering of the moment? Or am I helping to relieve that suffering? I want to spend a few minutes about the role of generosity in relationships. In the teachings, it said that when the Buddha first taught lay people about, he first taught about generosity and kindness before he ever taught people how to meditate. Generosity is the first of the paramis, and in Sims, we talk about it all the time. Many of you know we're in the beginning stages of a fabulous fundraising campaign called Growing Our Dharma Roots that's all about generosity. Generosity in relationships, generosity to our Sangha and within our Sangha, generosity to each of the yogis in our Sangha, whether we're part of it up close and personal or part of it from afar. So we can begin to practice generosity in relationships. What if we each practice making a priority of what the other person wanted in the situation? What if we could loosen our grip on our own desires, expectations, and see them for what they are, just desires? How would it feel if we could bring that level of generosity to a relationship? Now, I'm not asking anybody to be a doormat, you know, and no one's asking you to like submit to a controlling person or unreasonable demands. I assume the relationships we're talking about are ones that include honest exchange and compromise and mutual respect. Whether it's about the small stuff, like, what are we going to eat tonight? You know, because after all, it's only one meal. Or how the refrigerator is organized. Or about even the big stuff, like where you're going to live and how you spend your money. Generosity gives us an opportunity to investigate how it feels to contemplate giving in to the other person's preferences and desires. I recommend and invite you to practice this. That tightness that comes from all that clinging to expectations and preferences. Feel what it happens when that tightness eases. Just practice it now and then. See what happens. And if in your relationship there's the opportunity to talk about that, see what that feels like. See what the other person thinks about that. Many years ago, Bill and I in our business were being sued by a disgruntled employee, and we were in very different places about how we should proceed. We hired a lovely woman who's a mediator, and if you've ever gone through mediation, you say your position, then the other person has to repeat exactly what they heard until that you feel like you've really been heard. So we went through all of this, and in the end, we still had totally different opinions as to how we should proceed. And I remember Bill saying, because I owned the business, he owned the property at the time, I remember him saying, "I still don't agree, but this is your business, so I'm going to go along with what you want to do, and I'm not going to remind you some later time that, see, I told you so, it wasn't right." It was just that kind of a moment of amazing generosity. And both of us felt fabulous about it. This kind of practice of bringing generosity to friendships and relationships can be a powerful way to open up doors to a kind of freedom that we often don't experience. Another way to practice generosity in relationships is letting go of all the desires for that person to be different than they are. You know how, especially for those of you who are young enough and you still have parents and siblings and a family of origin that you still go back to visit, and you know before the visit how you intend this time it's going to be different, and you go back home and you get there and that uncle or sibling or parent who always asks, "How much money do you make?" And then they make all these comments about it. Well, why do you think this time is going to be any different? You don't have to like that behavior. But what would happen if you stopped arguing with the truth of who that other person is? Maybe there could be way less suffering. Something I developed some years ago might be useful here. I've shared it in a couple breakout groups. I started this because I have a very dear friend whose behavior and habits often hurt my feelings. For the benefit of this talk, I'm going to call her Jane. So when these moments of hurt feelings come up, I say to myself, "Let Jane be Jane." Of course, she and I have had talks about our relationship and how strategies for improving things, and maybe she could change her tone of voice and yada, yada. But when all is said and done, letting Jane be Jane is the most helpful. It feels inside of me to be an act of generosity, not just to Jane, but maybe even more so to me. If I let Jane be Jane, I have to take responsibility for turning her words or her tone of voice into something that can hurt my feelings. I have to take responsibility for making up the story that there she is, Jane hurt my feelings again. And there's that big circle and my little dot. I got to take responsibility. And it works on me too. When I find in situations that I'm getting hooked by somebody, I say inside of myself, "Let Suze be Suze. I don't need to go into a big story about it at the time. Later on, I can investigate and explore what is honestly beneath it, about why I got hooked and gain some clarity." But in the moment, when I say, "Let Suze be Suze," I just feel what it feels like to be hooked. Ezra Beda, the author of that book, At Home in the Muddy Waters, tells that when he and his wife were married, the one essential vow they made was to remember that each of them had the wish to awaken. He goes on to say that the practice is to remember, even in the midst of difficulty, that the other's inmost desire is also to become free from illusion. Well, I would add, just like Arv was saying in our meditation, that the other person has a desire to be happy, a desire to be free from suffering. To assume this wish, Beta goes on, in another, allows us, especially in those moments when hurt and fear arise, to stop the protective tendency to blame or fix the other. Instead, he says, we return to our job, which is to clarify and experience our own fears. There's this underlying paradox in being in relationships. All those pleasant feelings that arise as a result of those good times creates a reasonable desire to have those continue. It's natural and human. We can notice the desires as they arise and thoroughly enjoy them, all those moments. But when we start building story and expectation, we can remind ourselves that everything changes, including me. And what was pleasant last week might be unpleasant next week. Then there's the fourth of the fifth recollections, that we will become separate from everything and everyone we hold dear. I don't bring it up as a downer. Those recollections are not downers for me. They're a reminder that these connections, these relationships, these moments of joy are to be thoroughly experienced and savored. But no one ever knows whether this interaction might be the last one you have. Relationships can show us some of our hardest to break patterns. They can give us opportunities to show us our most generous and kind selves. They can show us where we cling to certain perceptions of how things should be. And they're the most exquisite opportunity to move beyond one's own sense of self, me and mine, and open up to the beauty of caring so much about another person that their happiness is foremost in your mind. Beta says, joy in relationships comes from being in contact with our essential connectedness, which most naturally expresses itself through generosity. He quotes Nietzsche addressing the sun, who wrote, "Oh, great star, what would your happiness be if you had not those for whom you shine?" May we exist like a lotus, at home in the muddy water. Thus we bow to life as it is. Thank you for your attention. It's such an opportunity to think about these people in our lives, these people who let us love them, you know. It's, of course, we're loved by them. But that gift of being able to love another person is really pretty remarkable. So, whew, I got all stirred up talking about this. So we're going to go into breakout groups. And, you know, as we start, I start to figure out how to do this. I'm going to give people a chance to say goodbye. If this isn't a morning that you have the time. Alrighty. So when you get into your groups, you know, what's the muddy water of your relationships? And how might you bring more generosity to them? How might you look at some of your expectations? And, you know, always if the suggestions that I make aren't the right ones, share whatever seems right for you. Okay, people are coming back. We'll wait a couple more minutes. If feel free to unmute yourself or use the raise hand in the reactions button or just wave or whatever. And how did the groups go? What's up? What's happening? What does anybody want to share? Sean and Bruce.
Well, two things. One was we were paired with another couple, which was just great. Was that you that did that, Suze? I don't know who did
that. It was magic. I didn't do it.
It was perfect. It was really perfect to share. And we shared about our relationships with one another, which was really great. Mm-hmm. But the main thing I wanted to share with everybody really is something came up in the group about parents, relationship with parents. And I just had this, I had a memory when I was like in my 20s, I was a young little hippie chick. And I had just flitted off to India to meet my guru. And my father, the colonel, did not approve. And we had a really contentious relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I came back from India and I was living in an ashram and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I was out there as far as he was concerned. I thought he was out there. And I went home to visit my parents. And I mean, it was obvious that my dad really did not want me there. And it was painful. And I remember, I have this whole memory when we were in our little breakout group, and I was out on the porch and I could hear my parents talking and my dad saying to my mom, I don't have anything in common with her. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to talk to her. I don't know how to be around her. And it was like, I just went, wow, this is not good. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be left with this if my dad should pass away. And he really wasn't even that old then. I mean, I'm older now than he was then. And I made a vow to myself that I was going to do whatever I could do to repair the relationship with my father.
It's beautiful.
But you know, he must have wanted it too. They lived on a golf course and I hated golf. He always tried to get me to learn how to play golf. I hated it. I thought it was just the stupidest thing. I went out on the golf course with him and I went, oh my God, you know, I'm going to hear all about his politics. I just, like you said, Suze, I just zipped it up and I went out on the golf course and I just surrendered and I spent a time doing what he wanted to do. And I think it was the beginning. And this repair of our relationship took place over many years. And as it turned into, he became my best friend.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, we got so close and I was with him when he passed away. And I don't know why I'm sharing all this. I guess I just was so touched by the sharing of parents, but.
Yeah. Thank you.
Repair your relationships if you can, make the effort to repair your relationships because it really pays off. Yeah.
Thank you for that. And of course, we all know that some repairs aren't going to happen.
That's right.
You know? And then there's a whole other kind of thing. There's that generosity to yourself and self-compassion and forgiveness processes, but they're taking the opportunity to have a moment of generosity. It's really just, it's like an experiment, you know, when I was saying, like, you know, well, what is, can you actually feel in your body some of the ease of tension? And I think your story is lovely, and thank you for sharing it. Anyone else who would like to? Rosie.
Yes, I really like that you brought up generosity. Joseph Goldstein, on his podcast, he has his own podcast, And I just listened to one where he was talking about generosity, and he talked about something I've heard about before, is when you have a generous inclination, just do it. And he told stories of how that paid off. And yesterday I was in QFC and they were selling the beautiful yellow, whatever those beautiful yellow, huge flowers. And I bought some, and I bought them for one neighbor who's been very generous to me. And I drove over there, and her car wasn't there. I assumed she wasn't home, but I had passed another's house, saw their door was open. And this couple is just an amazing couple. He has ALS in a very advanced stage. He can only use his eyes to work his wheelchair. But anyway, they're just the nicest people. The whole family cares for him and dedicated themselves to him. Anyway, they were so pleased that I stopped by and that I chatted and that I brought the flowers, and I felt so good about myself. I mean, they were feeling good about
Thank you, Rosie. The whole thing with generosity, they say, you know, you feel good when you're thinking of the idea, you feel good when you do it, and you feel good when it's done. You know, it's kind of an all-around great thing. So, yeah. Anyone else? We've got just a couple more minutes. Yes, please, Lillian.
Something that came up in our group that I thought was really interesting was the relationship with the self. I'm not sure if that's been talked about through the Dhamma talks, but I thought that was another, you know, just like open field for generosity and kindness. I thought that was really interesting. Yeah.
My, you know, let Suze be Suze is a little bit of generosity to me, as well as let Jane be Jane. You know, it's not as if the pain doesn't continue, but the suffering isn't there. It's like, it's that you let go of the second arrow, you know, that, thank you for bringing that up, because we all have the relationship with ourselves, and we bring huge expectations around how we should be. And, I said that really stupid thing again. Oh, I forgot to do this. Oh, I can, you know, what a klutz, whatever it is, you know, those kinds of expectations and judgments. I didn't even talk about that. So thanks for bringing that up. Yeah.